happy Wednesday, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Transportation and Logistics Podcast, powered by Atlanta Dispatch and Humblebee Enterprises. Very excited to be here with our brother John Seidel from Trucking Winds. But before we begin, I did just want to go ahead and say, hey, man, look, we're already into 2023. We're almost halfway through Q1. And those goals that you set, they're not going anywhere if you don't. You got to start sticking to them. And I'm talking to myself, really. This is me talking to myself about all the big things I wanted to do and accomplish in 2023. It's not enough just to set the goal. You got to take those actions every single day to get there. So if it's not speaking to you, I'm definitely talking to myself to just get serious about everything, because you know, it's a lot out here in this world, and you can definitely get it if you put that time and that energy into it and follow the plan. So, I mean, with that being said, I did just want to welcome my brother, John. John, how are you doing, man? How are you feeling today?
I'm doing good, man. It's been a long day. I had a couple driver meetings earlier, was talking to a bunch of drivers about some of the same things we're talking about here today. So, good day so far, my friend.
Oh, I love to hear that, my guy. I love to hear it. And, you know, this session right here is to discuss repairing the safety score, you know, and all the things that go along with that. I feel like there is a system that most people, at least, well, let me speak for myself, I didn't know about until recently. We're going to be talking about the data queue system. Can you talk about, first off, before we get there, look, you've got a lot of experience, right? I would love for you to be able to tell people who you are and how we can, you know, understand how you got all this game.
Yeah, man. So, like I said, I used to be a state patrol inspector. That's where I started this trucking industry experience. I worked the weigh stations, pulled over trucks, went through the whole inspections of level ones, level twos, threes, checked logbooks, vehicle maintenance. I did that for about a dozen years with the Wisconsin State Patrol. Then I became an investigator with the feds. So now I'm knocking on company doors, doing full reviews, giving them bad ratings, issuing fines and penalties. Left a little bit after that, became a hazmat agent with the FAA. So 20 years of government regulation. And I thought, man, I guess I'm going to go to the dark side and I'm going to leave that regulatory side. So I became a DOT consultant, and I'm also a truck insurance agent. So I own Trucking Winds. It's a training portal, like a location where you can get a bunch of training videos, monthly podcasts. And I also sell truck insurance for a company called Reliance Partners at reliancepartners.com. So
how was it being the feds? How was it being the inspector and being like in that enforcement role? Was it fun? Was it exhilarating, or was it draining? And were you tired of, you know, getting people hemmed up?
I'll tell you, as a state patrol inspector, it's kind of like you were out there just pulling over trucks every day. You know, whether you work the scale or you work on the road, finding trucks that are overweight and things like that. So it was pretty cool interacting with the drivers. You know, a lot of people, you know, give inspectors a bad rap, but overall, we're not all that bad. After I left the state patrol at Roadside, then I was able to go and meet a bunch of company officials, you know, like the owners of the company, safety directors. So I got to see the roadside side of the game, I suppose. And then I also got to see the company side. And it's kind of nice to well-round it, you know, like work with the company, work with the drivers, and get to see all those different perspectives. So I miss it, but I'm still out here helping truckers improve their score, helping drivers navigate hours of service. So it's still very rewarding.
Nice, nice. I love to hear it. Do you have any experiences or moments from your inspector days that, you know, just still stick with you? I know it's a million of them, but like anything that you felt funny, impactful, or anything like that, that you might be able to share. And I know that's random. So that's super random.
No, I think a big piece is all the training that I did at the National Training Center for investigators around the country. I developed this drug and alcohol technical advisory course where it helped inspectors and investigators do the compliance review. They would come in, check your random program, your pre-employment drug testing. If you have a positive driver, how you handle that. So it was pretty rewarding going out and being an instructor at the National Training Center for FMCSA for sure.
Nice, nice, nice. I love that type of experience. Definitely in the industry. You're in there. And, you know, to talk about, to transition into this topic, what's a data queue? Like, what's that system?
Well, before you get into data queues, let's talk about CSA scores.
Oh,
what
cool.
is a CSA score? Who invented this thing called CSA? And a lot of people think it might be for insurance companies or freight brokers or so the attorneys can go after you. But ultimately, the federal government invented CSA scores for the sole purpose of monitoring trucking companies to find out who is better and who is worse. When I was an investigator, they would send me into the companies that have high CSA scores. So if you want to keep the feds out of your company, you control your CSA scores. And data queues are simply one way to control those CSA scores, to keep the feds out of your company so you can do what you do best. Get loads, make money, keep the trucks running. Who wants a call from the feds where they got to slow down their operation to take care of all the compliance requests during one of those compliance reviews?
That's a good understanding as to why we are having this discussion, because 100%. Your safety score is definitely one of those things that can prevent you from getting that high paying freight opportunity, even that dedicated high paying freight opportunity. So thank you for bringing that in here. And as far as the system, you know, do you feel like people know about data queues?
I don't. And here's how it goes. The number one way to control your CSA is to not get violations. Let's be real, right? Don't get crashes. Don't speed. Wear your seatbelt. Use hands-free. Keep your brakes good, your tires good. We can go on about what generates bad violations bringing up your score. But what's a data queue? A data queue is challenging those roadsides, challenging those crashes. And to start, before we get into details about that, who can do a data queue? That's interesting. Anybody can do a data queue. A driver can log in, get an account to the data queue system, and he can challenge his own roadside inspections and crashes. Insurance guys, like I'm an insurance guy and a consultant, I got to log in and I do data queues for my customers. So whether you're a trucking company, whether you're a safety director there, the owner, operations, insurance guy, separate consultant, drivers even, you can all get a login and go in and challenge these inspections and or crashes.
Awesome. Let me ask this. I mean, because you are a consultant, you are a insurance broker, you know, agent, you have the ability to get access to multiple accounts. Let's just say consultant in this space is a dispatcher, you know, an independent dispatch agency that dispatches for 20 different motor carriers. Is that dispatch agency able to get access to all of those different motor carriers if they were also owning that compliance piece?
Yeah. So let's say that there was a dispatch company that manages 20 different motor carriers with the example you said. You can go in the data queue system, click on other, and just explain how you're a representative of these entities and you're basically challenging these inspections on behalf of them. So the only time I've ever run into trouble doing a data queue on behalf of one of my customers, just like a dispatch agency could do, is the state of Arizona. Arizona does require, if I'm trying to do a data queue for one of my customers that gets pulled over in Arizona, they'll say, we need some kind of email or some kind of letter from the motor carrier authorizing you to do this data queue on their behalf. But that's the only state I've ever run into that asks me for that information. So when I do a data queue in Arizona, I just make sure I get an email from the carrier authorizing me to speak on their behalf. Then I'll challenge whatever inspection they have or whatever crash they have, and we can get into more details of what that means. I'll challenge it on behalf of the customer in Arizona, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, New York. Doesn't matter the state. You just go in and submit the data queue.
Okay. Well, I love to hear that because, you know, as an independent dispatch agency, I'm always looking for other services to provide to my clients at the end of the day. And, you know, that sounds like something nice that could be owned by an independent dispatch agency. You also said that, you know, it can be a safety director, but it could also be a driver that goes in there to submit, you know, a data queue request or something to be removed. In your experience, how does it mean, does it hit a little differently when a driver is the one that is submitting that versus an owner or a safety director?
Well, I will tell you this. How many people out here, everyone on the call, how many people really knew that drivers can go get their own data queue login and challenge all their own stuff? I'll tell you, it's relatively unknown. So now, pretend you're the state police agency on the other side. 99% of the data queues you get are not from drivers. But if you have a driver submit a data queue defending himself, and then he can start getting personal, like, this violation is hurting my ability to be employed. This violation is on my MVR, and, you know, I can't be insured, so my insurance rates are too high. If you can kind of hit the soft spot, whoever's on the other side, you know, it's with human nature. If you can hit their soft spot, you have a higher likelihood of getting them to consider your data queue and changing and or removing the violation. Versus a safety director doing it on behalf of a driver, it doesn't hit home as much. So I think you hit it right on the head.
Because you've been the feds, you've been on the side handing out some of these violations and citations. You know, if somebody is going in after the fact to see if they can get some situations removed, does that enforcement officer, are they notified? I mean, do they take it personally if they are successfully, you know, found to be wrong?
Well, I would tell you this. Every state handles their own data queues. If you get pulled over in Indiana, then the Indiana State Police representatives will process your data queue. If you get pulled over in Wisconsin, completely different set of people, and it's whoever runs the enforcement in that state. So do you have some lack of consistencies from one state to another? Absolutely, yes. Some states will just handle it right away with whoever receives it. Other states, as a procedure, will send it to the officer that wrote the violation in the first place. And you might be saying, like, that doesn't make any sense. If you're trying to challenge the person that wrote it, why send it to the person? But what they'll generally do is get that person's perspective. If they say no, you can still add a response and request like an administrative review or a second opinion above that officer. So you got to kind of learn how each state handles their own.
Gotcha. I just would imagine if there was a particular enforcement officer that was consistently getting found to be incorrect, you know, there had to be some type of ramification, you know, within that state, within that system. They got to say, hey, man, you got to calm down over here or something.
Yeah, 100%. So I used to work in Wisconsin, and I've known some inspectors. We used to call them Mr. MSU, Mr. Make Stuff Up, right? So this officer would constantly get in trouble in his data queues, and then a lot of the violations got reversed. Well, the data queues in Wisconsin, for example, go to one person to start and then their supervisor. So you as an officer can get a reputation for kind of writing a lot of erroneous stuff. But at the same token, you as a trucking company or safety director, if you keep filing data queues that aren't substantiated by fact or law, you're going to get a reputation for being that guy, and you're going to have a less likelihood of getting your data queues approved. So it's kind of like a quasi check and balance system. The officers are going to be held accountable for stuff they do amongst their peers in their own management. Trucking companies are going to be held accountable for filing a bunch of data queues that are kind of frivolous and erroneous, and eventually you lose all your credibility. So you got to be careful. It's a balancing act.
Yes, sir. It sounds like it. Okay. So what all can data queues be run for? You know, citations, violations, what else?
Well, I like to break things into categories. So you said the word citation. So let's start with that. Okay. A citation means they issued you a ticket, right? And you got a court date and you got a fine and penalty. So, Jory, let's say that you get a citation for a seatbelt and I'm another driver for the company, and I get a warning for my seatbelt. A lot of people are like, "Ooh, I got a warning. It doesn't hurt my CSA score." Not true. Warnings and tickets hurt your CSA score exactly the same. There's a point system, and I could talk about that later, but there's a point system. It's like knowing the rules of a game called CSA. So 7 points for a seatbelt warning, 7 points for a seatbelt citation. However, if Jory goes to court and has that ticket dismissed with no court costs, you can do a data queue with the court document, submit it to the state, and they will remove all points associated with your seatbelt ticket because you got it dismissed with no court costs. If you get it reduced to a lesser charge, like seatbelt turns into a parking ticket or equipment violation, it goes from 7 points to 1 point. So you getting a citation, hiring an attorney, getting it dismissed with no court costs or reduced is better than me getting a warning for it because I can't go to court. So I'm stuck with 7 points. You can get 0 or 1. If you go to court and it's not dismissed or reduced, you're still stuck with the 7, but that ain't no different than me anyway, right?
Right, right. So look, I mean, you're on a roll, but let me ask this. If somebody was to be handed a warning, can they say, no, give me the real thing so that I can see about getting this taken off?
What's cool about this is the conversations you're starting are ones I hear every single day. So now here's what'll happen. The officers start to realize that you can do a citation dismissal or reduction, do a data queue and get the violation removed. So they purposely won't give you a citation because they don't want you to go to court and have your CSA scores reduced because of a court action. But here's what officers will also do. True statement. A seatbelt hurts your unsafe CSA score. If you're overweight, it doesn't hurt any of your CSA scores. So if you are not wearing your seatbelt and your truck's overweight, many officers will write you the ticket for the overweight and write you a warning for the seatbelt because the seatbelt hurts your score and you can't go to court. And the overweight ticket, even if you go to court, it doesn't hurt your CSA score anyway. So you see the game that's kind of played?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, when you hear it from this side, it's eye-opening to say the least.
100%. So can you still fight a seatbelt warning? Yeah. So let's say you had a camera that faced the driver. You know how they have cameras that face the road, cameras that face the driver. A lot of people don't like them facing the driver. But let's say this trucking company clearly had a camera that faced the driver the entire time. And they get a warning for a seatbelt violation. Can you submit the video or screenshots of the video to the data queue person and say, look, that driver had his seatbelt on the entire time. That officer was wrong. He only took it off after he was pulled over, right? That video evidence could absolutely get that seatbelt violation of 7 points removed, even if there's no ticket. That's how data queues also work.
Okay. Okay. So the difference between a citation and violation is, you know, a ticket being written where you got to go to court versus a violation being potentially just a warning type of situation. Is that what I got?
Well, look at it this way. A seatbelt violation is a seatbelt violation. Both of them hurt your score. If you get a ticket, you just got a ticket for that violation. If you get a warning, you got a warning for that violation. You can data queue the violation. You just need proof. And a ticket dismissed or reduced, that document in court is your proof to get it off your record. If you get a warning, that's when you need to get some other kind of evidence submitted in your data queue to get it removed. Many people think the only way to get something removed is a ticket reduction. That's not true. I win a lot of data queues based on merit and facts.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you for that. And when you are going through the system and you're requesting that the information be taken into consideration, I know that you said that it really just depends on the entity, the state itself that's doing the reviewing. Is there like a maximum amount of time that they can spend on it before they have to give an answer?
I'll tell you what, the answer to that's absolutely no. It's sad, man. But it is what it is. Wisconsin, who I used to work for, they process data queues that are not crash data queues. We'll get to that in a second. But they process data queues in Wisconsin that are given to them very quickly. There's been times where I'm on an airplane with Wi-Fi, I do a data queue, and then I land, and it's already approved. But now, Minnesota, for example, the state of Minnesota, they take forever to process data queues. I don't know why one state can take a month or two and the next state gets it done in an hour or two. It's really not fair to the carriers that are domiciled in that state and get more violations in that state because it's harder to control your CSA scores if they're not processing these quicker.
Gotcha. And let's just say the that you go through the process and they do agree that it needs to be reduced or removed altogether. Is there, how long before it actually shows up on that motor carrier safety score that, you know, they are going to be removing that score? Like, is that something that's relatively quick?
All right. So a good thing to know about CSA scores is this. The last Friday of every month, the government does a snapshot of every violation that makes up your score in the last 2 years, right? So everything that's still in your system for the last 2 years, on the last Friday of every month, the government goes like a camera snapshot. About a week later, they post your scores. So if you do a data queue and get it approved within a few days, generally, of the last Friday of the month, you can expect to see that data queue will be valid, and that violation will be removed or adjusted by the next month. But if you get that data queue approved on the first Monday of a month, you got to wait that whole month for the snapshot and then another week for it to get off your score. So there's a lot of push to get data queues done and processed and approved by the end of a month.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. And you kind of alluded to this. Data queues for accidents, data queues for crashes, are those different versus you know, doing it for a violation or a citation?
100% different, because you never get a citation simply for crashing. You get a citation for whatever caused the crash. So if you were inattentive, you get an inattentive violation with a citation that hurts your unsafe CSA score. But then if the crash is a DOT recordable crash, it'll hurt your crash score. So a citation or not getting a citation, there's no way to data queue a crash based on citation alone. The way you data queue a crash is twofold for the most part, if it's your crash. There's something called the Crash Preventability Determination Program. The government has a PDF file that has a bunch of specific crashes outlined. If that happened to you and it's not your fault, you can do a data queue using that guide, and they will annotate the crash as not your fault, and it will not hurt your score. So everybody on this call, you should get every single crash report in a PDF, open it up, then open up the eligibility guide, compare the two. If it's a round peg in a round hole and you can data queue it, you should. If it's a oval peg for a round hole and you think you can kind of force it in there, you should still try. If it's a square peg in a round hole and you know it doesn't qualify, don't even waste their time, because then you get a bad reputation. But should everybody be grabbing crash reports and comparing it against that guide and doing data queues to remove your CSA score for crash? Absolutely.
Awesome, my guy. Awesome. So, you know, what the takeaway from that part right there is, it seems like this is very standardized. Things that people have access to can actually go look it up themselves. You know, they just got to kind of have to know exactly where to go to get it. But you said that there is a data queue, you know, fact determining sheet as to whether it's a preventable situation. What's in your experience, what's one of those situations that's a really preventable or something that could get removed from your record through the data queue process?
All right. So let's do this. I have a trucking company. Mm-hmm. And in the last year, They got about 50, 60 owner operators. In the last year, they had three crashes that fell under this program. And then they had another crash that I will explain in a minute that falls within another type of data queue. But the three crashes, here's what they were. A drunk driver went 100 miles an hour and smashed into the back of our trailer. If you open up the eligibility guide, it says, if somebody is charged with drunk driving and they hit you, it's eligible. Nice. I mean, not nice, but nice, right? If you get hit directly in the rear, it's eligible. So we had a truck rear-ended by a drunk driver, ended up in a fatality, struck in the rear. That one got removed. We were going through a green light with another crash, and a car blew through a red light and T-boned our trailer. That's an eligible crash. And then we had another one where a car was going in the wrong direction and it completely crossed the center line and hit us head on. Now that's a weird one, Jory. If the car is 100% across the center line, it qualifies. But if the car's only like 80% across the center line and the rear tires are still in their lane, for whatever reason, it doesn't. But I was able to data queue these three crashes for a customer, and their CSA score went from 76% to 3%.
Right. And, you know, just for everybody to understand, higher is not better when it comes
to higher ain't better. Higher ain't better.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate you for explaining that. Let me add this other scenario in there while we're still on the topic. Let's just say that we're in a parking lot and the tractor trailer is running down the main part of the parking lot. And there is somebody that's approaching that street where that semi is going, but there is no stoplight. And they, for some reason, miss the stop sign or the fact that there's a big old truck, rolling in front of them, and they T-bone them that way. How is that?
All right. So in that same guide, which, you know, I can send you a link to this and they can check it out at whatever location you can send to them so they can read through this guide themselves. If a car leaves a driveway and there is no stop sign, it's not eligible. So if they're coming from a side street, there's no traffic control device like a light, a yield sign, or a stop sign, they determine that not eligible because there was no stop sign there. But if there's a stop sign there, it is eligible. Another goofy one, man, is if you're driving down the road and there's a deer in the road and you swerve to miss the deer and you crash, it's not eligible. But if you hit the deer, it is.
Right. That makes sense. That definitely makes sense because they're going to say, or this is what I'm presuming you would know. You would know it from the inspector side and the insurance side that, you avoiding that deer, but you ended up hitting somebody else, that was not that other motor carrier's or that driver's fault. You did that. So you're at fault.
Well, that's one part to look at it, but let's look at this. You're driving down the road and a deer jumps in front of you. You swerve to miss the deer and you just hit a street sign. And when you hit this sign, it's pretty big and it knocks your radiator out. Well, now you have disabling damage. It requires a tow because you broke your radiator, and that's part of the definition of a crash. Well, you can't challenge that because it was a DOT crash because of the radiator, and then you can't challenge it because you didn't hit the deer. You didn't even hit anybody but a street sign, and you only hit the sign because a deer ran in front of you. But it's not eligible according to that guide. There are many people that complain about the fact that a lot of crashes that are not your fault, where there is no other victim, you still can't get him removed.
Wow. Wow. Now, I hear you.
Yep.
I hear you. That could be a headache.
You got to learn these details, right? So now, where do you find this information? I'll tell you. You find it on shows just like yours, right? You bring a guy like me on. You get a guy like you who cares. Me and you have a conversation about this. And then the listeners are like, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And that's what's called value through education. That's what it is.
Yes, sir. I agree. I definitely agree there. And, another thing that I'm imagining a lot of violations are handed out for, and citations are through the hours of service. The driver failing to, keep proper hours of service. Do you feel like it's easier or more challenging to get ELD and other hours of service violations removed from the record via the DataQ system?
All right, so there are several basics, and hours of service is one of the CSA scores that's the most volatile, right? You don't need a whole lot of CSA violations for hours of service to end up in that alert status that will give you a trouble getting loans. It'll cause attorneys to go after you. That'll cause the feds to come knock on your door, right? So hours of service, it is difficult, but not impossible. An example would be this. If you are a local driver, 150 air mile radius, short haul driver who's exempt from a logbook, but your company decides to make you run a logbook just because it's easier for tracking and running your hours of service, right? And you get pulled over for not having an instruction card and a blank set of logs, or maybe your ELD wasn't mounted, or you didn't put the bill lading or the trailer number on. Hell, you didn't sign it, right? All those are hours of service violations. However, if you're a short haul driver exempt from hours of service, you're using the ELD voluntarily. So I have won numerous data queues where I grab a piece of paper and I say, on this day, we were pulled over for all these hours of service violations for ELDs. We're exempt from an ELD because we're a local driver. Please remove all of these violations because we're not required to have an ELD. All we need is a time card with the time start, time finish, total hours, name, and date. If you can demonstrate that to the officer on the other side of the data queue, you'll get all those hours of service violations removed because you know more about the hours of service than maybe the driver and or the officer even asked those questions.
Right. What does that mean again? I hear it all the time. 150 mile, air miles. What is that?
Mm-hmm. All right. So a good industry to focus on for this is intermodal, right? You go to the rail yard. Most intermodal carriers, they start at the same place for their shift. They run back and forth to the intermodal, the rail yard, and then they end their day in the same spot. So, Jory, I'm going to ask you 5 questions and pretend you're an intermodal driver picking up chassis at the rail yard. Number 1, do you report to work and stay within 150 air miles of where you report to work, which is equivalent to 172.6 as the road goes, 172.6 statute miles. Say yes. Say, yep, I stay in the circle.
Yes.
So you stay in the circle. That doesn't mean you can't go over 150 miles. You can run 300 miles, just stay in the circle. So, Jory, do you you start and report to the same spot and stay in that circle? Yes or no?
Yes.
Perfect. That's the first of 5 questions. Number 2, do you leave and return to the same spot within a 14-hour shift? Say yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Perfect. Your 14-hour shifts, do you always get 10 hours off? Sure, right?
Yeah, got to.
Yep, you're good. All right, do you drive more than 11 hours in that 14-hour day? You better not, because you can't. It's over the hours then, right?
Mm-hmm.
Last question. Do you have some kind of record that has your time start, time finished, and total hours each day? A time card, an app that shows time start, time finish. Say yes.
Yes.
All right. So on that day, did you answer those 5 questions correctly? You stayed in the circle, 14-hour day, left and returned to the same spot, 10 hours off, didn't drive more than 11, and you have a time card. You are a 150 air mile radius driver that day, and on that day, you do not need a logbook. Your time card is good enough. No ELD, no logbook, none of it. You just record your time.
Gotcha. Okay. You see it written down all the time, but you're like, what does that really mean to, air miles? What does that mean, my guy? What does it mean? Okay, well, cool. I appreciate you explaining that. And, there are some things that I just wanted to just go through real quick, because we got you here. And we want to talk about the hours of service and how those violations impact, you know, the CSA scores and how this data queue system can get those things removed if, you know, properly done. All right. But there are some common myths that you probably can just dispel very, very quickly. And, you know, the first thing is we've all seen this, you know, those trucks that are lined up along the on-ramp or the off-ramp. Most of the time it's around the evening because there aren't any truck stops available with parking. Are those folks at risk for a violation or a citation?
Those folks are at risk for quite a bit, depending on what signs are posted on those on-ramps. If it says right on the on-ramp, no parking on the on-ramp, now you're illegally parked. So you could get an unsafe violation for improper parking, and it could hurt your CSA score. Now, let's say some car is coming up the on-ramp, and they kind of lose control or don't pay attention, and they smash into your truck or trailer that is illegally parked on the road, and they get injured. Now they're going to try to sue your company because you're parked in a spot where it's posted that there's no parking allowed there. So it could hurt your CSA scores. It could absolutely hurt you when you get sued. Now, if there's no sign that says no parking, you're better off than if it says there isn't. But you got to make sure that it's legal to park there or you could be in trouble with those things. Now, one last piece about personal conveyance. Let's say you are legally parked on an on-ramp or an off-ramp to a rest area. And a state police guy comes up, knocks on your door in the middle of your break and says, I don't want you parking here. You can't be here. Personal conveyance allows you to push a button in your log, drive off duty if a safety official tells you to move. So you are 5 hours into your break. Officer comes up, knocks on the door. It's legal to use personal conveyance to go find a different spot if a safety official is the one that told you to move.
Okay, gotcha. And let me ask that question in such a way, or ask a question in such a way that makes that relatable. Let's just say that driver is at a shipper or receiver and they have just been loaded or unloaded, but they were in their sleeper when they were completed. And now that facility is the one telling them they need to move. Is it the same rule?
No, depends, but there's a different personal conveyance provision in the scenario you just gave me. It says in the PC, after you're done loading and unloading, you're allowed to use PC to go to a nearby, reasonable, safe location as long as it's the first location available. So after loading at a shipper receiver or unloading and you're over hours and they tell you to leave, you're legally allowed to use PC to drive on a road in the off-duty status as long as you go to a nearby, reasonable, safe first location. So you don't need to use the safety official provision. You would simply use a different provision in PC that allows you to go to the closest place after loading and unloading.
Okay. All right. Now, you know, here's another real quick one. Let's just say that the carrier, the driver, made it to the facility. They have an appointment, but in waiting for their appointment, they ran out of hours, but they still got to get that truck. They got to get that trailer docked up. Is there a way to do that so that they're legal in doing it? They just aren't finessing the system by, you know, possibly moving at less than 5 miles an hour so it doesn't trigger. Is there a legal way to do that?
Well, 100% yes. Now, the way I'm about to tell you, most drivers hate it, but it's still legal. Let's say you're in a shipper. Let's say you're at a shipper or receiver for 5 hours and they knock on your door and say, okay, we're ready for you. The driver's like, that stinks. I just did 5 hours and now I have to move, which is work related. If I use PC to go to the door, it's not legit because it's working. So you would use what's called yard move. Yard move is allowed in the ELD and or paper logs, and it's legal. It's driving the vehicle in the on-duty status. Instead of it hurting your driving line, it hurts your on-duty time. Now, that will screw up your 10-hour break. but you're allowed to work over the 14th hour. You're allowed to work after you already drove 11. You're allowed to work after you hit 70 hours. You just can't drive on a road after you maximize the hours. So even if you're over the 14, took a 5 hour break, you can push yard move at the shipper receiver. It'll put you on duty. You can back up to the dock. The only problem is you just broke up your consecutive 10-hour break.
Gotcha. So then you have to, learn, or you have to understand how to do the driver split so that it works in your favor. So I understand that driving splits are, they can be a little bit tedious.
Yep, I think you broke up for a second there, but you said something about the split in that scenario. I love that you
Exactly
brought
what
that
I
up.
said was, in what you just said, it does break up the 10 consecutive hours in the sleeper. But, if you are familiar and you know how to leverage your driver splits, that's when you will be able to, display those skills so that you can still move on when you need to move on. And what do you feel like the hardest part is in utilizing driver splits, time splits?
Well, let's go back to the scenario we just had
Okay.
because everybody just heard what we said, right? You got there on time. Then you're delayed 5 hours. Now you're over the 14, but you started a 5 hour break. Then you push yard move for, say, 45 minutes to do a little work up to the dock. Now you're loaded, right? And let's say they'll let you stay there. They'll just let you stay there. It's not a problem. You go to the sleeper berth and take 7 hours consecutive in the sleeper. So now, Jory, what did I just do? I took 5 hours off duty waiting. Then I did 45 minutes of yard move. Then I do 7 in the sleeper. Well, the 7 in the sleeper is a minimum you need to split. You have to have at least 7 in a row in the sleeper berth. Well, then I can grab 3 of the 5 hour delay, and that is my 10. So I just took a 10 hour break at the shipper using yard move in the middle. Yeah, I lost 2 of the 5 hours, but I didn't lose all 5 of them. So a driver should do 5 hours off duty, 45 minute yard move, 7 sleeper, and they just split their log at the shipper.
Okay, so I do understand that, and I pray that others do that. Basically, we're talking about adding up this, 3 of the first 5 hours that we use, and then we're going to conjoin that with the 7 hours that we're doing in the sleeper. But let me ask this: what if you don't know that you need to be off duty because you think that they're going to get to you? Let's just say it's a first serve facility where you got there early in that window, but they're just backed up, or there's a million trucks ahead of you. How do you, I mean, is there a way to go through and say it's off duty time after the fact, even if that wasn't the plan up front?
Well, here's what I'll tell you. There's a lot of things drivers may or may not do, let's be honest, right? How is an officer supposed to know whether you were off duty or in the sleeper if you're at a shipper, unless they have cameras, etc. But let's talk the reality of it. In the scenario I gave you, if you get there and you think that you may be delayed for the whole 7, then get in the sleeper right away and start logging sleeper berth, right? If you think it's only going to be 3 or 4 hours, but not 7, the smaller period in a split does not have to be sleeper berth. It can be off duty or sleeper or any combination. The only one that has to be sleeper is the bigger one that's 7 hours or 7.5 or 8, right? The small one can be anything, line 1 or 2. The big one is the one you need. So if you think you're going to hit 7 hours, then you should go in the sleeper right away.
Gotcha. It seems like when I think about administering or applying the driver split techniques, I can hear these time frames, but then what I find is, it's a little bit daunting for me to know when to go back to do the counting. Do you have any, rules of thumb or anything that you could really say to say, hey, this is how you know when you're supposed to start counting these hours so that you can know what hour you would be available to get back on the road.
Well, I'll tell you what. Split sleeper is complicated and difficult to explain in 3 minutes.
100%.
I break split sleeper into two categories, and this is since September of 2020. Prior to this, it wouldn't apply, but since September of 2020, these categories work. One, I call it splitting without really splitting. It's where you're still taking a 10-hour break at a truck stop, but you're a smart driver, and you make sure that you're taking seven and a half, or eight in a row in the sleeper whenever you're at a truck stop. Then when you start driving and they delay you for 3 or 4 hours later, if you can add the 3 hours to seven in the sleeper that was part of the 10, those 3 hours in the middle of the day, they don't count towards your 14. So you can extend your day past 14 as long as you're doing sleeper berth consecutive as part of a 10-hour break, the shift before or after your 14-hour day, you know, the off-duty period. So my rule of thumb for drivers is this. Every time you're at a truck stop, every time, do your best to get in that bunk and stay in there preferably 8 hours in a row or at least seven. So then later in the day, if they delay you for 3 or 4 hours, you can add it to that sleeper that was continuous as part of the 10 and extend your day. If you don't need it, so be it. But if you do, you already did what was necessary to extend your day. And in that case, you're not really splitting because you're not breaking a 10-hour break into two periods like I did at the shipper. You're simply taking a 10-hour break and making sure 7 or 8 is in the sleeper so you can extend your day later with off-duty time.
Gotcha. So that's splitting without splitting. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to go through Trucking Wins and, you know, watch the video explanation and tutorial on this. So I understand it. And I know that the, you know, the other ways of actually applying this, the time split, the sleeper split, becomes a lot more involved. And, you know, I mean, if you want to try it, you can, but I'm not going to ask you to go to, you know, go through the details of, you know, doing a split, you know, unless you feel like you can summarize it pretty, it's up to you, brother. Do you want to take that or no?
Well, here's what we'll do. Like you said, Trucking Wins. You can go to splitsleepersecrets.com/S as a promotion here. I have a 47-minute split sleeper video on my website, and that's what you're referring to. One of the examples I give is you can drive from New York City all the way to Los Angeles over 4 days and never stay at a truck stop for a full 10 hours. And I'll kind of explain it the best I can, but the details are in the video on Trucking Wins. If I drive, if I start in New York after a 10-hour break and I drive for 6 and then I go in the sleeper for 8, then I drive for 5, the 8 doesn't count towards my 14. So the 6 and the 5 is my 11. So I can do 6 driving. Now we're not doing pre-trips and all that, just for the ease of the explanation. 6 driving, 8 in the sleeper, 5 driving, 2 off duty, 6 driving, 8 in the sleeper, 5 driving, 2 off duty. If I keep doing that, I do the 6, I do the 8 in the sleeper, I do the 5, I hit 11, I add the 2, that's my 10. And I can do 6 and 8 and 5 and 2. 6 driving, 8 sleeper, 5 driving, 2 off duty. 6 and 8 and 5 and 2. 6 and 8 and 5 and 2. 6 and 8 and 5 and 2. And I can do that the whole way to California. And I will not be in violation.
Gotcha. It's a lot of game in there. You know, I did put that link into the chat. It's also on my link tree. If you click on the link at the top of this, here, you can find the site that he just mentioned there. And of course, it's truckingwins.com. Let me ask you, this is going to be the closing question that I have. And if there were any questions from the audience, you know, if John has the time, we can, you know, we can field a couple. So raise your hand if you had a question. But this is the last question that I have for you, brother. Well, you've been an inspector. You've been on, you've done a lot of things, and now you even, you know, added insurance sales to the repertoire. You know, what would it take for you to become an asset owning, you know, motor carrier operating in the market? Like, what would have to happen for you to start operating?
Are you talking about me starting my own trucking company?
That's exactly what I mean. What right. would it, you know, have to align for somebody that has all the background and all the peripheral experience in the industry to jump in there as an asset owner and operating a trucking company?
Well, I would tell you, most truckers are great at working with their trucks, working with their trailers, getting loads, managing drivers, and getting them hired. The biggest problem in running a trucking company is navigating a lot of this compliance and reducing costs of insurance and keeping these CSA scores under control, keeping the government from coming and giving you bad ratings, et cetera. And there's no college degree. You can go get a degree in OSHA, but you can't get a degree in the DOT. Where do you find information like this? At websites like truckingwinds.com, or they jump on your podcast. We have this really good conversation and we fill their head with as much knowledge as we possibly can within an hour. So what would like entice me to become an owner of a trucking company? No offense to an owner of the trucking company, but I wouldn't do it because I love what I know, right? And I don't know how to do all those other things that a trucking company is great at, but I know how to help you with your safety and compliance. And I would rather help thousands of trucking companies through Trucking Wins than try to start my own and only bring value to my one company. I take a lot of pride in helping drivers navigate personal conveyance, split sleeper secrets, how to pass a roadside inspection, owners, how to keep the feds out of your living room, digging through your underwear drawer and giving you fines and penalties and bad ratings. So that's what makes me tick, you see?
Yeah, I got you, brother. Man, that was a nice way to bring that full circle.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to say this, man. Look, visit this brother's website, truckingwinds.com. I did ask if there were any questions. I don't see any hands raised right now, and we definitely are going to respect this brother's time. So I'm going to go ahead and leave that open for 10 seconds. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. All right, I'm turning that off. And, you know, at the end of the day, again, visit this brother's site. John, did you have any closing remarks, anything that you wanted to talk about on the way out?
Listen, I'll just tell you, come check out truckingwinds.com. The reason I started this is I sell truck insurance, and I have about 120 customers that I provide insurance for. And a lot of those customers struggled with getting new drivers and educating them on a lot of the things that you can find at Trucking Wins. Why did I start Trucking Wins? I actually just started making videos for my trucking company customers. And then they're like, we really love this, John. This is great. And I'm like, why would I just restrict it to the 120 trucking companies I help with insurance? Why not offer this to everybody? Because I think I got a lot of value to bring. And I can't do that unless I do it through Trucking Wins or podcasts like you, Jory. So I appreciate you bringing me on, man. This is what we need to help these truckers and educate them. So knowledge is power. Try to go find the knowledge. If you can't find it, you come see me. I'll help you the best I can.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Well, look, again, everybody, we truly appreciate the support. As always, I mean, this group started from this clubhouse, the Transportation and Logistics Clubhouse, started from me transitioning from corporate America and wanting to be more of a, you know, having the ability to control my own destiny. I didn't want to get fired in the pandemic. And through that, you know, in trying to educate myself, we've been able to foster a community of just, you know, knowledge share, people that have been gracious enough to share their wisdoms and allow us to grow and strengthen as a community. So I'm extremely grateful. And so on Monday, as always, we're going to be partnering with FreightWave Sonar Team to let you know where you should position your trucks to take advantage of the market. And next week, we're going to be talking with a major company that has opportunities for those who are drivers or who are interested in getting their CDL. So tune in next Wednesday for that. But John, I'll talk to you soon, my guy. I appreciate you for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate you too, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you.